Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc. All rights reserved.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting when the evening comes.
We're back. It's 12 after. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate, and I'm glad you're here. And I'm glad Joan Pride's here, too, because otherwise this wouldn't be nearly as much fun this hour. Joan's senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. Joan, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Jim. Good morning.
Good morning to you. It's good to have you back, as always.
Thank you. Thank you.
Joan, let's get right into the letter and talk about... We've got some really fun stuff to talk about a little bit later on, folks. As you know, the letter that we work off of is the last letter that Kiplinger produced, and sometimes... From the time the letter is published until we get on the air, most of the stuff that we talk about is still pretty darn current.
But not all of it is.
But sometimes...
Yeah, I wonder what you're referring to,
sometimes
Jim.
Sometimes things happen, and we're... and listen, I've got a little bit of egg on my face, too, from this.
Oh, that's on page four. We won't get to that today,
we're
over
on page four. We'll talk about that in a little bit, but we'll stand by for that, folks. That'll be a lot of fun. Joan, you know, folks, some of the most fun that I get to have in any given... week is hearing Joan Pride talk about currency exchange issues. She's like the queen of currency exchange explanations, right, Joan?
If I'm your queen of currency exchange, then you're pretty desperate.
we're in big trouble, right?
Real desperate.
The lower dollar is a short-term plus for the U.S. economy, according to Kiplinger. Joan, tell us about that.
Well, as I understand it, now don't quote me, but when the dollar is lower, that... makes our exports cheaper and therefore increases our exports, and it makes it costlier for other countries, theoretically makes it costlier for other countries to import goods into the U.S.
That's exactly right. And, you know, Joan, you and I joke about this, but I really have, over the last few years, I have tried really hard to become more knowledgeable about the currency exchange issue because it is affecting small business owners more than it ever has before, probably. But you're right. If you think about it, if our currency is weaker against other currencies, now don't ask me me or Joan probably to explain how it gets weaker, but if it's weaker, that means that where we used to have three shells to trade for their three shells, now we only have two and a half shells to trade for their three shells.
That's right.
And so we got to figure out how to come up with another half shell somewhere. Which means that now that's when we're buying their goods, but when they're buying our goods, it gives them that half shell advantage, doesn't it? And that makes, as you say, that makes our goods worth more to them and to their importers.
Right, I think so.
Yeah, and so this is good for the dollar being weaker is good for anybody that exports from the United States.
Yes, that's right.
Whether that be goods or services.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Across the board.
And so it's been good for our manufacturers, and that as you guys point out, and it's also been good for our service sector, which, as you know, Joan, we're becoming more of a service country.
Oh, no question about it.
Yeah. But now here's the interesting thing is that you guys point out at Kiplinger is that the currency is not weak. The U.S. dollar is not weak against all currencies, only certain ones, right?
Well, and this is what I had not really realized, and I learned something here, too, because some currencies attach themselves to the U.S. dollar, and I guess most notably that China's, is it yuan or?
The yuan.
I don't know how
you
pronounce that.
Uh-huh.
But China's currency... is tied to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And we're saying that they don't plan to float their currency for another year. We would like them to, but they haven't done that yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I said theoretically a lower dollar makes imports more expensive and harder to get into this country. But in the case of China, that's not necessarily true. And China is a big, huge importer into the U.S.
Well, when a country wants to really compete hard with the U.S., especially some of these third world countries, they peg their currency to the dollar.
Yes.
And as you say, they don't float it. Floating means it stays on the market. The market determines what it's going to be.
Right.
And like the euro and what else? The yen, the Japanese yen.
Right.
And
I know there's the British pound.
And the pound, right. The euro and the pound and the yen. And so those currencies float. And so they're now stronger than ours, whereas the Chinese yuan is pegged to the dollar. So if the dollar drops, so does the yuan. And they,
yes.
And our manufacturers get no advantage with the Chinese manufacturers.
Exactly.
So consequently, the U.S. is trying to put a lot of pressure on the Chinese to float their currency, and they're resisting, aren't they?
Oh, they sure are. We're saying not this year. It won't happen.
Yeah, but maybe next year, I think, is what I think you guys are predicting.
Well, we're saying 2005 at the earliest.
The earliest, yeah. And the thing is consequently, whereas maybe our balance of trade now then, and folks, this is where it affects all of us, our balance of trade may be reconciling a little bit, maybe getting a little more in line with the three currencies that float that we talked about. With currencies like the Chinese yuan, we're not improving our balance of trade with them.
Right, exactly.
And now that that's crystal clear, right, John?
It works for me.
Let's talk a little bit about. Let's jump back up at the top of page one, I'm sorry. This dollar weakening actually is contributing fairly significantly to our national production, isn't it? Our national output.
We say it's going to add 0.5% to GDP this year.
Yeah.
And that's because of the increase in exports. So that's good news, certainly.
There's no question about that.
Yeah.
Which is very good, but it's also creating problems for our so-called partners over in Europe, our trading partners in Europe. I started to say friends. Some of them are, some of them aren't.
Right.
But the people that we do business with in Europe is creating problems for them because they're trying to get their economies going again, and our weaker dollar is behaving sort of like the Chinese yuan is with us, isn't it?
Exactly, and that's the problem for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not exactly sure how all this is going to play out. Obviously, what goes down must come up again, so I'm assuming the dollar is going to strengthen before long. But until then, they're going to have problems, I think.
Now, folks, I'm going to make Joan sweat a little bit. When we come back, Joan's going to tell us how the U.S. made the dollar go down.
Oh, no.
And then after that, she'll pull a rabbit out of the hat.
I got to run.
20 after. Stay with us. Back at 23 after. Joan Pride is our guest and our good friend. She's senior editor with the Kipling Editor. So, Joan, have you got it figured out now how the U.S. makes the dollar go lower?
I have absolutely no idea.
We've got to figure that out.
But I can tell you who helped bring it lower.
Who does?
Was the Bush administration by not, you know, there's this phrase, talking the dollar up and talking the dollar down.
Yeah, jawboning.
I'm not saying that this caused it, but they helped the slide. Secretary of the Treasury Snow was asked about this several times, and he didn't say, "Oh, we hate a weaker dollar. We're going to prop it up." He fudged it, and that signaled to the markets that a weaker dollar was okay with the administration, so it kept going lower.
Well, one of the things that you might say, well, what's all this mean to the average person out there, the average small business owner or investor? Joan, you guys point out that a weaker dollar makes acquisitions, makes investment in the U.S. worth more. Whether they buy a company or they buy stock, it makes foreign money coming in here, investing in the U.S., which, Joan, as you know, was a big part of the run-up in the 90s.
Well, that's true.
So we might say, well, we don't want those foreigners coming over here and investing our money. Well, it actually kind of helps our stock market, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
and which that's the good thing with regard to the currency, but the bad news with regard to getting foreign dollars in here to give us some liquidity, Joan, is the interest rates.
Right. Well, and what we're saying is that even though this is a good deal for foreigners, they may start to get nervous seeing the dollar drop, because a weaker dollar may be a sign of a weaker economy in their eyes. And if that's the case, they may start demanding more return on their dollar, and that would help push interest rates up in this country, and we sure don't want that.
Mm-hmm. But unlike some currencies, Joan, people aren't ultimately fundamentally worried about the dollar. They know that this is just a time in history when the dollar's weaker.
I'll tell you what, though, the one thing that there's very little, I think, to be worried about in this economy. The one thing there is to be worried about is the deficit.
Yeah, the structural deficit.
Yeah.
I think it's important that we delineate between the sort of the war on terror, the Iraq war deficit, and the Homeland Security deficit, and what people call the structural deficit.
Well, there's a whole federal deficit that's not structural, that's more than just the war on terrorism.
Right,
yeah,
exactly.
There's two parts of it. There's the regular deficit, and then the deficit that won't go away even if we were to do away with domestic spending completely.
Yeah, yeah.
Which involves the entitlement programs, mm-hmm. Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and the interest on the debt.
But when I say the people that have been on the show, the economists that have been on the show and have talked about this, Joan, they're saying that, you know, if the war stopped right now, if we solved all the terrorist stuff and we didn't have to spend for Homeland Security, the spending versus the revenue, you know, not counting the entitlements, there's still a structural deficit there. I think that's what you're talking about there. Let me see. One of the things that you pointed out is that even with the lower dollar, this is not going to reverse the tide of manufacturing jobs ultimately moving offshore. This is going to, it may slow it some, and it may make some changes in that in the manufacturing sector, but it's not going to really change the ultimate fate of this.
Right. Here we say the U.S. is still pricey. It's still cheaper to locate those jobs overseas generally.
Mm-hmm. You know, Joan, some of the big companies have gotten some, you know, taken some hits because they moved some jobs overseas. And the truth is, those companies that people are complaining about are international companies. They may be based in the U.S., but they do a lot of business overseas.
Right.
So it's natural that they would have jobs overseas.
Sure.
And they're going to have to, and we need to get over that. We need to get over this thing about where the jobs are. I mean, we may not like it, but it's just one of those things that we're going to have people, as we move into the 21st century, Joan, you know this. I mean, we're going to be moving the flow of capital and information and human productivity is going to be fluid all around the globe, isn't it?
Right, and it has been for some time, and it's just going to continue that way.
That's exactly right. Okay, let's move over to the top of page 2 and talk about some things that I'm not really happy about, Joan. It's costing me a lot more to fill up my car this last month or so.
Well, I guess the good news is we're saying that the prices will start retreating in March, so you're going to have a bad winter, but as the spring rolls around, things will get a little better.
I'm paying close to $1.60 for medium for the 89 octane.
Oh, we're paying well over that.
Yeah.
Probably closer to $1.70 here.
Yeah. And I'm not talking about the high octane. I'm talking about the mid range.
Right, the medium. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's pretty sporty. I sure was hoping that we were going to get, you know, back to $20-something barrel oil, but
if you get rid of that Jaguar, you wouldn't have that problem.
I wish I had a Jaguar,
yeah.
Miss Lexus. But
you're right.
But now you guys say that oil may spike to $38 a barrel in the next few weeks,
which is huge. Even $35, which we say is the price now, is huge to me.
Yeah, especially when you consider what was it? Only a few months ago, it was that way down in the 20s.
That's right.
Yeah. Stand by, Joan. We'll take a quick break, folks. We'll be right back with our good friend Joan Pride, senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. The show is brought to you by IBM and Office Depot.
He inspires barbarians a lesson in Western methods and efficiency that will put them to shame.
He tells it like it is.
I realize how difficult it's going to be in this godforsaken place where you can't find what you need, and there's the challenge.
He's Jim Blassingay, the small business advocate.
With all due respect, sir, I believe this is going to be our finest hour.
We're back at 34 after. I'm Jim Blassingame, the small business advocate, and Joan Pride is our guest, and she's senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors, and they've got an outstanding group of publications, folks, that I'd like to encourage you to check out, and you can do that at their website at kiplinger.com, K-I-P-L-I-N-G-E-R.com, and the site is outstanding. You can find a lot of free information there, but also you can find out more about their publications, which includes the weekly flagship letter, now in its 81st year, and that's the Kiplinger letter, and now, I've been a subscriber for many years, and like the other three, the three biweekly letters, the California, the tax, and the agriculture letters, they all come either one of two ways, or both ways. I get them both ways, and that's electronically or in print. And then they've got a magazine that comes out once a month, right, Joan?
That's right. It's called Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine.
Typically, what's in that? Isn't there a lot just about personal investing and that sort of thing?
Investing, but also a lot of other things like financing a college education, financing your home, a lot of stuff like
home
that.
Home budgets, managing your own money, whatever,
right.
That, whether that be investing
right.
or saving
right.
or whatever, right?
Yeah, and also, like we'll also do reviews of, like, buying cool stuff, like the latest cars, latest cameras, things
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
So you could we tell you how to spend your money besides investing it.
Right, and that's it. And you can find that at Kiplinger.com, and they also got a phone number you can call for a subscription, right?
That's right. Our toll-free number is 800-544-0155.
Is my 30-day free trial still available, Joan?
The Blassingame free trial, yes,
yeah.
It is.
All right. So I worked hard for that one, folks, so check
yep.
that out when you get a chance. And they'll actually let you give their publications a road test for 30 days and see if you like it. Joan, let's move down to the middle of page two and talk about banking. This is a topic that's very interesting to me. And as most people know, J.P. Morgan, Chase, and Bank One recently merged, right?
That's right. And that's going to become the second largest bank after Citibank, which is mm-hmm. number one in the United States. But I guess the news here isn't that there really isn't a whole lot of news. This is something that we've talked about before. Whenever there's a big bank merger, everybody wrings their hands and says, oh, community banks are going to die. And then we have to come in and say, no, they've still got a very important place in the financial world. Because, as you know, there's a lot of people who get fed up with these mega banks, don't feel like they're getting a lot of service. And the community banker is still going to be there, particularly for the small business owner.
No question about it. No question about it. If it weren't for independent community banks, most small business owners wouldn't be around, Joan. And I am an exact profile of what I just said. If it weren't for the independent community bank that I've done business with now for many, many years, I wouldn't be talking to you right now. I would not be here if it weren't for them, because the smaller banks are just more able to give the kind of attention and develop the kind of relationships with people like me, small business owners, than the large banks are. It's just a way of, you know, Joan, I found out that a lot of independent community banks still, even small banks, use credit scoring, the computer model that calculates whether the bank should loan money or not.
Yes.
But what independent banks do differently than I think the big banks is they take that credit score and they use it as an indicator. They don't use it as the edict.
Right, it's an indicator, not the indicator.
That's
right. That's a very important distinction. And if now, how about this for a segue? If I'm not mistaken, you mentioned community banks in one of your New Year's resolutions.
Absolutely. You remember what I said?
Which I think was whoever you're banking with, make it a resolution to get to know your one of your community banks in your
There's
area.
What I say is that every small business owner needs two banks minimum to be doing business with, and one of them must be an independent community bank.
Right.
That's absolutely fundamental to being a successful small business owner. And, you know, Joan, there's an example on this banking situation, the people wringing their hands about whether banks are going to be, the little banks are going to be around. The banking experts that I've talked to, especially my friend Mike Menzies, who's our banking expert in our brain trust, Mike says that the general feeling is that over the years, the banking industry is going to look more like a barbell.
We have even said that ourselves, right?
Yes, yeah, I guess you have.
And it's the mid-sized banks that are sort of disappearing.
They're going to be in the thin part of the barbell, the handle
right.
part. And the
right.
big folks on the folks who are populating the big bell part on both ends are the big banks on one end and the tiny banks on the other end.
Right.
And so, you know, these independent community banks, and by the way, folks, ICBA is the national organization. If you'd like to know more about them, they're friends of mine. They're good folks. And ICBA, I think, .org is how you find their website. And so check that out when you get a chance. If you want to know where an independent community bank is in your area, and you know what? They don't pay me a penny to say that. I just believe in them. 20 till. Stay with us. We'll be right back with Joan Pride. We're back at 17 till. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate. Let me remind you, coming up in the show straight ahead, Bill Dunkelberg is going to join us. And he polls small business owners, hundreds of them, every month. It has been now for over 30 years. And produces a survey of what they have to say about what's going on out there in the marketplace. And when you hear Bill on the show talking about that, as we've been doing now for a long time, you get to find out if what he's learned, how it compares to what you're seeing out there in your marketplace. And that's coming up in the show straight ahead. Joan Pride is our guest. She's senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. Joan, and this week you guys predicted, basically, that India could become the next China. Tell us about that.
Well, we say it's on its way to doing that because they've been instituting a lot of economic reforms, but just as importantly, they've been sort of trying to make nice with Pakistan. You know, that's a pretty mm-hmm. volatile situation over there. But they've been working on that, and we think they're going to be on target for very rapid growth and not, you know, not far off from China's pace.
Let me put this into a worldview, Joan, and I'm going to quote Frederick Bastiat, as I like to do at least once a week in a minute. And you know, Pakistan and India both have nuclear weapons, and they've been pointing them at each other. As you know, Joan, we have had
yep.
a few tense moments in the last 3 or 4 years with those two guys. And so some people might be saying, oh, no, more globalization. India is now going to take jobs from the U.S. This is a bad thing. Well, but you know what, Joan? Now I'm going to quote Bastiat.
Okay.
When goods cross borders, armies don't. The more India trades with the world, especially the U.S., the less likely they are to become a threat to Pakistan, because they're not going to want to mess up that those economic relationships because of some little bitty tiff over a place like Kashmir.
Right, and that's something that we have said about China in the past.
Exactly. No question about it. When goods cross borders, armies don't. Ladies and gentlemen, globalization is going to be the vehicle that will create, come as close to as anything to creating global peace, and where human beings, and I don't want to sound like a Pollyanna here, Joan, but where I believe we've got an opportunity this century, where human beings can quit fighting each other and start trading with each other. Does that make me a Pollyanna?
Oh yeah.
Okay. Well, I believe that.
We
though.
Like Pollyannas. It's okay.
But you know what? Pollyanna wasn't wrong either. She might have been cliche, but she wasn't wrong.
Right.
I was in love with her too, by the way, Joan. Have I ever told you that? Okay, on to page 3. The job picture, Joan, is very interesting, and it's really a paradoxical issue, isn't it? This year.
Well, it doesn't, you know, look that good right now, but we're saying that those numbers are going to be revised upward, and it's really actually going to get better pretty soon.
Well, the interesting thing is that we could actually, you know, I predict, one of the other things I predicted, Joan, was that at the end of the year, 2004, we would have annual gross domestic product, annual growth in this country of over 5%, and unemployment of over 5%. And I said that was a rare, if not an unprecedented event that I was predicting. And the reason is because there are a lot of people who, you know, the increased productivity in the United States is going to hold down the employment figures. It's going to increase, you know, hold up the unemployment numbers. And, Joe, we're already finding out that a lot of people are going to stop looking for jobs and just start their own small businesses.
That's right.
We're already seeing that.
Which means even more entrepreneurship.
That's exactly right. And the thing is that's the reason I say it's such a, the paradox is that productivity and the economy will grow, but the way we classically identify unemployment will also stay pretty high. And so I think we're going to have to look at the way people are productive differently, maybe a little bit in the future. What do you think?
Well, I hadn't thought of it that way, but yeah.
Okay, let's move down and talk about the HSAs. That came into being with the signing of the Medicare bill in December. Joan, tell us all about those.
Yes, well, HSAs are very interesting, and we think they're going to be very interesting for small employers because, as you know, they can be set up either by individuals or by employers on behalf of individuals. But the key is that the person that they're being set up for cannot already have a full-blown health insurance plan.
And Joan, health savings accounts. I don't know if either one ever said that, but HSAs are health savings accounts. Go ahead.
But whoever is being covered by this can only be covered by something with a high deductible already.
Right.
And the idea here is, we think that this is a way to help small businesses provide health insurance where they may not be able to afford to right now. But the only thing is there's a lot of questions still to be basic questions still to be answered about these accounts because the IRS still has to write regulations for them.
Yes. But the expanded portion, the HSAs effectively replace the MSAs, right? The medical savings accounts that were individual policies people would buy.
Yes, exactly.
But where the difference is between HSAs and MSAs, primarily, Joan, if I'm not mistaken, is that the employers, as you were alluding to, can contribute to, they can actually provide an HSA for their employees, whereas they couldn't do it with the MSAs.
Right, the MSA did not have that component, and that's why we're saying that, you know, let's say you have an employee who really can't fund their own health insurance, you can do it for them.
Well, and Joan, now we're lurching controllably or uncontrollably, it still has to be defined, toward what you and I have been talking about for a long time that we needed, which was portability.
Good thing.
Yep, absolutely, no question about it. Quick break, we'll be right back with Joan Pry, senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. Here's ZZ Top to take us out.
And try to meet the masses. Go get yourself some cheap sunglasses.
We're back. 7 till. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate. My website is www.jbsba.com. Don't forget to subscribe to my free newsletter. Comes every week by email. And don't forget all the other cool things you can do on my website. And if you just can't get enough of Joan Pry's voice, you can go back and hear her all the rest of the day on the replay. And I know many of you out there, many of the Joan Pry groupies out there just really want to hear her. You can hear her forever and ever on the archives, right? Right, Joan?
Oh, yeah, forever.
Yeah. Joan, let's talk a little politics. This is where it's going to get fun. And I want to go all the way to the bottom of the page for this one.
We should go in order here.
I don't want to.
Let's give the president his due.
I don't want to wait on this, Joan. I don't want to run out of time. I'm afraid.
All right, let's get it.
Here's.
Now wait. What's the date of this letter? What's the date?
I've already told him that.
January 16th.
Joan. I've already told him that. Here's the headline, folks. But I'm poking fun at me too because I got caught up in this too. Here's the Kiplinger headline. Dean is still the favorite.
Not no more.
That's the truth.
No more, he's not.
Your mother would not be happy with you, Joan. Not no more. What happened, Joan? What happened to Mr. Dean?
Oh, he just melted down. I don't know.
There's something about, you know, there's something about him that's just irritating. I felt that way. But when I made my prediction, and I'm laughing at myself because I predicted that he would be the nominee.
Well, you know, one of the things about Iowa's politics at the retail level. The guy face to face, and I guess they weren't happy with it.
Well, and Joan,
the talk now is that he's not presidential.
I didn't I underestimated. I knew he grated on me, but I didn't. I underestimated how much he would grate on the Iowa Democrats.
Yeah.
And apparently, I think two things happened. I think they got to know him out there, and I still say that moment in time when Kerry was on the podium and the guy walked up whose life he saved in Vietnam, I believe that was a moment of time that changed that campaign out there. What do you think? Would you agree with that?
Well, I don't know. I don't know a lot about that moment. I do know that he was reunited with that man, and the man has agreed to work for his campaign. But I didn't realize it got that much media coverage.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it got a lot of coverage. And and I got the feeling that the guy just kind of walked up and sort of surprised Kerry. That it wasn't really...
So this wasn't staged.
Well, now, I don't know, but he sure acted surprised.
Come on now, Jim. Let's not get naive here.
No, I'm trying to be fair. But
okay.
But the thing is that Dean is now, and in his reaction to all this, he's kind of gone off the deep end a little bit, hasn't he?
Well, he had 2 minutes of getting a little punchy at the end of a speech, and of course everybody's replaying that over and over again. I think Jay Leno said something like, you know you're in trouble when you need your staff to hit you with tranquilizer darts to get you off the stage.
Well, see, that's the kind of ignominious references that doesn't make you appear presidential, isn't it?
It just reminds me of Michael Dukakis in the combat helmet sitting in the tank.
Yeah, you're right about that. But I mean, I really thought the only reason why I thought he could be the nominee was because he did have a grassroots effort. He's raising a lot of money. He really come out of nowhere and was doing really well.
Well, he was focusing on first-time voters, too, which I thought was interesting.
Exactly, but I couldn't see anybody else that could really emerge as a contender. And you got to admit,
right,
Joan, a month ago, we wouldn't have picked Kerry, would we?
Oh, not in a million years, I don't think. Maybe Gephardt, but of course he's flamed out, too.
But on the other side of the aisle, Mr. Bush had a pretty good, had a big day this week, didn't he?
Well, he gave his State of the Union speech, as he has to do every year.
Yep, prescribed by Constitution.
That's right.
And which he did, and he basically started his campaign that night, didn't he?
Oh, definitely. That's the way it looked to me.
I don't think I've ever seen a Republican president give a State of the Union speech and spend as much money as he did. He sounded like a Democrat spending all that money, didn't
right.
he?
It is an election year, you know. Yeah.
All those new programs that he came up with. But, you know, Joan, he also drew the line in the sand with regard to his tax cuts. And those things that he finds he holds important,
yep.
And I think that's going to be the basis of the campaign this year.
I think you're right.
Yeah, and you know what, folks? I can't think of a better statement to end our visit on than what Joan just said. That'll resonate throughout the airways for the next.
I think you're
long,
right.
Next week, Joan said right. Jim Blastingame was right. Hey, Joan, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Jim.
Took a nasty little turn at the end there, didn't it?
I know.
We'll see you next week.
Okay.
Joan Pride, ladies and gentlemen, with the Kiplinger Editors. I got to go for this hour. Before I do, I want to thank my heroes, small business owners. This is Jim Blastingame, the Small Business Advocate, and this program really is for you.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blastingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.